With much of North America in a deep freeze right now, covered with ice and snow, I imagine a few of you folks out there are doing some California dreaming of your own, or I hope you're all warm inside listening to the program with the coats and blankets and thermal PJs and mukluks or whatever you need. Good story tonight. When They Appeared is the name of the book about Stefan Mihalik's amazing encounter, which had profound consequences for his family and is one of the best documented UFO cases in history. It makes you wonder why it is not more highly regarded and doesn't get more attention. When we come back, we'll jump into some of the supporting evidence, additional witnesses, physical evidence, and the search for the location where this occurred. We'll be right back. Stan, I'd like to ask, were there any other experiences that your father or other members of the family had? A lot of times you have UFO cases, dramatic encounters with the unknown, and that sets off sort of a chain reaction of strange, unrelated events, seemingly unrelated.
Oh gosh, no, nothing of the kind. My father already had enough stories to fill a book about his wartime experiences. My mother as well. No, our life in Canada was pretty average, pretty normal, right up until 1967 when things got a little abnormal.
We had talked about sort of the media coverage and the tone of the coverage and the influx of UFO-related organizations and investigators. What about debunkers? I'm sure Chris is familiar with some of the names of the prominent debunkers of that era. I would imagine a case like this would be very tempting for them to jump into. Stan, do you know of any attempts to smear your father or his reputation?
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. I'm a skeptical guy. I'm a bit of a cynic as well. When someone presents me with a story, my first reaction is usually, really? Well, let me take another look at that. And I think with this story, what's interesting, and we're all sort of looking at it in hindsight, so we're a lot smarter now than we were then, but it's everything that occurred to my father is documented, is investigated, is cross-checked, double-checked, rechecked. So what happened to him and the fallout as a result of it is all supportable. The only one thing that stands out in this story that makes it remarkable is what it is he saw. Was it terrestrial or was it not? And that is really the only thing that it can come down to, because everything else, his injuries and the sequence of events and time and place, these are all things that are supportable. So when a debunker steps forward, really all that he or she can say is, well, I either believe it was or it wasn't. And beyond that, everything else has supporting documents.
And the description that he writes in his own words is very specific. I mean, sights and sounds, the colors that would change, the description of the craft, the smells. Chris, it's a wealth of information, and I'm wondering why the case is not more highly regarded or better known.
That is a good question. It was part of the Condon book. And so Blue Book, interestingly enough, didn't list it in its original file. It actually just a newspaper clipping made it into Blue Book. But and yet Roy Craig from the Condon Committee, on behalf of Blue Book, investigated, came up here with the intent of trying to understand what was happening. And he was not impressed with it. He had his own views, of course. He was a bit of a debunker. I was convinced that all this was nonsense. The fact that there were so many, amazing elements of this really confounded Roy rather than spurred him on. And the valuation in his report was something along the lines of, if this case could be proven true, it would definitely prove the existence of UFOs in the skies over North America. He didn't seem to think it was bona fide. And yet, in the opinion of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the opinion of the Canadian Air Force, both of which conducted very, very intensive investigations, they left the case unexplained. They said they have no way of explaining all the details of this particular case. In fact, very recently we had the opportunity to speak with one of the original RCMP, no, Air Force officers, who's still alive. No, RCMP officer, sorry, who's still alive. And I asked him point blank, you know, what do you think this was? And he says, I have absolutely no idea what Mr. Mihalik had seen. So it has a lot of interesting elements here, and yet, like you say, not a lot of people know about it. It has been written up in a number of books. We were involved with Unsolved Mysteries, which did a segment on it. A&E and a few others did segments on this particular case. So it's not like it's, you know, completely unknown, and yet for some reason, despite the fact that it has all the elements that a good UFO case should have, never really got the attention it deserved. We have the physical evidence. We have a willing witness who did talk to investigators and reporters. There were materials found at the site. We haven't even touched on the fact that there was debris and artifacts found at the site, which were tested by a number of laboratories throughout North America.
Well, let's get into that now. You know, the story of Stefan not really knowing where it happened and not being able to find it immediately. I mean, he stumbles out of the wilderness. He's disoriented and hurt. And I guess for a while, Stan, he could not find the place, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty good as far as being in the bush. I mean, he was normally quite comfortable, but having been injured and coming out onto the highway, actually a mile west of where he went in because of, you know, his stumbling around, when the investigators said, well, we're going to find the site and you're going to help us do that, they put him in a helicopter. Now, 1967, so you can imagine what kind of helicopter this was. It was like something out of MASH. And they took off. Now, my father has never been in a helicopter in his life. And in he climbs, and off they go. And he is looking down at a terrain that has changed or is changing rapidly in the spring. And he's disoriented. He can't see. He doesn't know where he is. So, again, the problem was not that he couldn't find the site. Had they said to him, well, you know what, walk us through exactly what you did on that morning. Take us from the spot that you left and walk us in. The chances are pretty good that he would have found the site. But they had him going over hill and dale, and he was lost, and he could not find it. And frankly, many efforts and many attempts to find the site failed. It took him a while before he was able to actually find it, but he found it the way he should have found it in the first place, and that is retracing his steps and doing it the way he did it on that morning.
And when he finds it, he goes looking for supporting evidence and material, and he's accompanied by a guy you describe in the book as sort of an odd character.
Yeah, he's a bit of an odd duck. I mean, I don't understand even to this day what he thought he could do to help Dad. I think this fellow, Jerry Hart, I think he had been up this road before, where he had been in the media, he had been hounded by the press over his own political views and so on. So I think he sympathized or empathized a little bit with Dad, and I think he said, look, I know this is hard for you. I can help you. Let's see if we can't find this. And they did. Now, it didn't really matter that Dad found it on his own, because within a short time, the RCMP and the Air Force were both out there en masse. And the site was as he left it. I mean, there it was. And there was enough there to suggest that something odd indeed had happened there. So there was plenty of evidence on the ground and enough that made the RCMP and the Air Force both very puzzled as to what could have possibly happened.
So there was soil that had higher than a normal background radiation in it and some metal samples. Do you know what happened to those, Chris?
Yeah, Chris actually has one of those in his very home right now.
Well, don't brag about it. Somebody could break in and grab it. Have you had it analyzed?
I don't think. Yes. Chris can talk to that. Okay. I think more than
that. Yeah. There were two in 1967 when the RCMP and RCAF went out there. They did find some radioactivity in the area. In fact, the radioactivity was of such intensity that they considered closing the entire region to the public. And considering this was a sort of the equivalent of a state park, this would have certainly caused some uproar. They decided against it eventually. But in fact, they didn't want to send some of the samples they had retrieved by mail because of the radioactivity that was in these particular samples. And then in 1968, Mr. Mihalik went back out to the site sort of on the anniversary when the trees and the region looked a lot more like what he had experienced back in May of 1967. And he and his companion found additional material. In fact, they found some very puzzling metal samples that were tested later by a number of laboratories, not only by University of Illinois, but the Atomic Energy Commission of Canada, which was the equivalent of Oak Ridge. They found that this material was pure silver that was also radioactive. And, you know, and it was not just a little bit. There were a couple of metal bars plus a number of globules of silver. So we're talking about hundreds of pieces of very unusual material found at the site where this UFO had set to land it.
Is there any marker there? I mean, if people went to look for it, would they find it?
There's no current marker there. I know people have geocached the area now. Curiously enough, over the past year or two, there's been some interesting developments. The Canadian government issued a commemorative coin recognizing that this was a significant event in Canada's history. And that there's a move now to try and put some sort of a permanent marker just at the roadside to indicate that this is a historic site for Canada as well. So soon it's expected that there will be something out there. You can actually go there by horseback, which is the easiest way in. It's you know, fairly rough terrain, but there's a number of ways to locate it. There's some enterprising people who've organized tours out there. So it is accessible.
Yeah, there should be Falcon Lake Festival of some sort, the Woodstock of...
Someday.
Yeah, wouldn't that be interesting? George, I can tell you that at the area there, Falcon Lake is a resort community. There's a lake and golf course and so on. There's also a riding stable, and the folks that own the riding stable have for a number of years organized rides for the public to ride out to that spot. They were able to zero in on the spot, locate it, and now, of course, they know exactly where it is. And Chris and I went out there in 2017 on the 50th anniversary, and we actually went to the spot. And it is just like Chris describes it. It's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it is rock and trees and swamp and water. That's all that's there.
Chris, you've studied thousands of UFO cases and written several books. Have you ever heard a description of the vent system that Stefan encountered and that burned him?
Not really. It certainly was quite unique. In some ways, it does resemble some of the other cases throughout history, but you know, that's one of the puzzles of ufology is that in some ways, no two UFOs that were seen at close range seem to be alike, and that confounds the mystery trying to understand what these creatures or machines or whatever they are might be. So it adds to the mystery, but it's you know, again, it conforms to the basic stereotypes, standard Hollywood-style flying saucer with the dome on top. Other features, the fact that Mr. Mihalik said that this thing didn't appear to have any seams. It was like some sort of one, as if it was milled from one entire large source of metal. And that has been reported a number of times as well. And when this door opened and he saw these lights streaming out, and he had seen inside we would now consider some computer lights, like on a 1967 ENIAC device flashing on and off on a panel inside the thing. And he noticed that the thickness of the wall was actually quite significant, too, of the order of about a foot. So it's all consistent with some sort of machine, as he described it, and was certainly one of the few people who had gotten that close to something and unfortunately got a little too close because he was injured.
Well, like I said, in his personal account, there are some very specific details. The changing colors, which you hear in a lot of UFO reports, mm-hmm. The sulfur smell that stuck with him, I guess, for a long time.
It did, yeah. I think it's important to remember that his background as an industrial mechanic and eventually as a millwright, he was an artist. He painted, he drew. So for him to sketch the craft while it sat on the ground and to add in things like approximate dimensions and details about the color and the metal and all that stuff, that's typical Dad. I mean, that's very typical of his observation. And for him to look at this craft and to almost admire, how it looked and how it was built, again, very typical. And I think it's important to note that at no time in his life, right up until he died, at no time did he say to anybody, this was absolutely extraterrestrial. When people asked him what he saw, he would answer with, I don't know, you tell me. And I think it's important that we don't automatically assume that this is extraterrestrial. But all of the other evidence and all of the things that we know about what was going on in the world in 1967 certainly points in that direction. So, you can say one thing and believe another. And wow, that is a hard road to hoe.
What about long-term effects on the family? You have siblings, Stan, yep. And I wanted to know how it affected them. And then your parents' marriage. I mean,
my parents' marriage wasn't great to begin with. My mother rejoined my father with his son and daughter, my brother and sister, 10 years after he came to Canada because of what was going on in Poland, the political situation. They did not get out of Poland until 10 years later. So she came to Canada to reunite her children with their father, and she came based on duty and obligation as much as anything else. So their marriage was not terrific to begin with. It was based on a lot of traditional, this is what you do, this is what you must do. So they were already not estranged, but they were on difficult ground. My sister really distanced herself from what was going on in the home. She was going to university at the time. She was also on a TV show singing. Her career was to be in voice. So she really did not want to partake. My brother, on the other hand, was the family guardian. He was probably 19 or 20 at the time, and he became our doorman. He became the filter. He became the guardian. And he literally fielded all the phone calls and answered the door and tried to insulate, I guess, Dad from the outside as much as possible. So he really remembered the time in later years. He remembered the time as being very stressful. I was bullied in school, of course.
I'll tell you what, we're going to come back to that on the other side. Need to take a break here right now. Talking about when they appeared, the Falcon Lake 1967 encounter with Stan Mihalik and Chris Rutkowski. We're talking about a 1967 close encounter case that's among the best documented of all time. When They Appeared is the name of the book by Stan Mihalik and Chris Rutkowski. In a moment, we'll take a couple of your calls. Hopefully, folks, you can sort of stick to the story that we're covering here tonight, or a related story, maybe a sighting in the same area in Canada. There were other witnesses to this encounter, or at least the craft that looked the same as what has been reported by Stefan, and we'll get into that in just a moment. Stan, before the break, we were talking about how this affected your family long term. Did you and your siblings talk about it? Did it ever come up in family conversations in the years that followed?
Yeah, absolutely, we did. I think we did not want to pursue it. How to put this? We didn't want to become enthusiasts of the sort of the UFO movement or the UFO phenomenon. We were only concerned because this had happened to our family. Once it was done and sort of petered out, we were content to leave it like that and not get into it. And I think, you know, you asked earlier about, you know, how come this case, while it has all the earmarks of something spectacular, hasn't been given as much airtime and publicity. I think it traveled through time on its own. It sort of gained some traction, and then it kind of disappeared, and then it picked up again and then disappeared. And I think that's typical. We certainly didn't want to do anything, and I think the only reason that we wrote the book is a few years ago, Chris approached me and said, we have to do something. It's the 50th anniversary coming up. Perhaps we should set the record straight once and for all, keeping in mind that you know, back then there was no internet. And now on the internet, when you read about the story, you get a lot of false information and a lot of misinformation. So we said, okay, well, let's do it. Let's put it all together in one place once and for all. And I think what has happened is it's generated interest with a new generation. So that's probably why the story has sort of ebbed and flowed over the years, because people lose interest and then it's regained. I think it was the same in our family. We were sort of happy to be done with it.
Chris, as you know, I mean, there's a lot of attention in UFO matters these days here in the States anyway. I'm not sure if the same is true in Canada to the same degree, but because of ATIP and all the stuff that's come out in the New York Times and subsequent media reports. But there's been a renewed interest among the public, television programs sprouting up all over the place. And to some degree, researchers, investigators are taking fresh looks at older cases. We had Calvin Parker on this program last fall, and you know, he hadn't really been out front talking about that case, but I think investigators realize that these older cases can be mined for new bits of information, and taking a fresh look at them can help with a broader understanding of the topic.
Absolutely, and you know, this is an interesting case in that it's one of the classic nuts and bolts UFO stories. You know, we don't have those as much anymore. It's probably one of the last great ones. You know, there's no elements of downloads or repeat experiencers and things like that. There's no abduction involvement. There's no contactee association, although some contactees have made some statements over the years about this particular case. This is a case where something, you know, physical seemed to have occurred. It was investigated by, you know, military, by police, by other investigators. I reopened the case in the 70s because I was trying to understand more about what was occurring in Canada. And it's, you know, been a real hallmark for the Canadian ufology community. So it is true that, you know, we're going back and looking back at some of the classic cases and finding more information and shedding some insight. In fact, this case has relevance to some other cases that occurred in Canada in 1967, which was indeed a banner year.
Before I go to the phones, one more question for Stan. Did your father ever speculate about why him? You know, was he special? Why would he was allowed to see this? Because so many people who want to see something like this don't. We don't exactly know why some witnesses are allowed to see it. It's that almost the occupants, whoever they are, the craft, allow certain people at different times, whatever their criteria are, we don't know. But did your dad ever just kind of kick that around?
No, I think one of the things he said was he was one of the unluckiest people on the planet. You know, he was in the middle of nowhere alone. And really, when I say the middle of nowhere, I mean for many, many, many miles. So it's odd, and I think he was content to believe that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Oddly enough, if this craft was terrestrial, and if they wanted to land for some reason, there was a gravel pit not far away that had a perfectly flat, smooth, and very discrete area that they could have landed in. If it was extraterrestrial, I'm sure they would have seen a number of better places to put down than a rocky outcrop in the middle of nowhere. So, we speculate till the cows come home. I can tell you, though, that Dad himself always believed that he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Let's take a call east of the Rockies, Joe with Long Island. Good morning, Joe.
Yeah, hi, Chris and Stan. My question would be, Canada itself is really sparsely populated in relationship to the land area, like you said, in the middle of nowhere. And that's my question. It just seems like any place in Canada would be almost in the middle of nowhere.
That's true. And, every year, I put out the Canadian UFO survey, and we get about 1,000 cases every year. And, most of the cases come from populated areas, although we do get some from remote areas. But, yeah, in terms of the relationship between large, sparsely populated areas and denser ones, it's pretty something, all right.
Thanks, Joe. There were other witnesses who came forward to have at least described similar craft in the same area around the same time, right?
Yeah, in fact, a number of people, once the story broke and it was in the media, people did come forward saying that they had seen some similar things. Similar in the sense that they were, appeared to be structured craft, not necessarily the exact same shape, the same description, but, there were cases in the area. 67 was quite a big year for UFOs, not just in Canada, but throughout North America.
I had asked before about debunkers, and the one that came to mind, of course, was Phil Klass. I can't imagine that he would skip writing about this. I recall reading somewhere, maybe you mentioned it in this book as well, the excuse that it looks like Stefan had fallen on a barbecue grill, and that must be what happened to
him.
Right. I don't know who suggested
and the,
that.
The silly thing about that is if you fell on a hot barbecue grill, the burns on your chest would be these parallel lines, and they wouldn't be the holes between the lines, which is what was on Mr. Mihalik's chest. So, even absurd comments like that just show that the skeptics weren't taking a really good look at this thing at all.
And Stan, did anybody ever try to make it into a movie?
No, in fact. What an interesting notion. That's how far do we want to pursue this? Well, you never know.
Yeah,
Chris, maybe. In the documents that you were able to get, there were some tests done on the metals. Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, there were some labs that did test it. I mentioned the Atomic Energy Commission of Canada, which, as I mentioned, is the equivalent of Oak Ridge. They took these pieces of metal. The metal was also sent to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Crime Lab for analysis. They did a metallurgical analysis. They did a radiological analysis. Also, the University of Chicago and a few other organizations and institutes took a crack at it. And, of course, this explains why we have so little of the material now, because pieces were given to various people, organizations, and institutions by the Mihaliks. And, we only have one particular chunk left now, and we're regarding it fairly well. But back then, the analysis was done, and we have those analyses. The documents are around pure silver with some impurities, and as I mentioned, there's some radioactivity associated with it. You put a Geiger counter near the piece, it does go clickety-click. So there was something strange going on, and one would have to try and figure out why would melted silver be in a crack in a rock in the middle of nowhere, and why would associated radioactivity be found with it. I do know that the Canadian government was convinced that somebody had hoaxed this, and they actually went to a nuclear waste disposal site, which is not all that far away from this area, thinking that somebody had dug some nuclear waste up and seeded the site. So they were taking it very, very seriously indeed, but of course nobody found any evidence that that was what had happened.
There was a reference in the book to somebody trying to nick one of the pieces with a knife. You recall that?
People had said that maybe Mr. Mihalyk was trying to create his own nuclear bomb by banging pieces of uranium together or something. And there were other individuals. Stan mentioned Jerry Hart, who probably had some ideas along those lines as well. But there's so many ways that you can try to tear this case apart. But the point is, why? There didn't seem to be any goal. The Mihalyks themselves were shy of media. Mr. Mihalyk, had no real motive for doing this. And even the logistics of, bringing some devices or material into a swampy area, some distance from civilization to create a hoax, you'd have to wonder why they didn't do it a little bit easier in a better fashion.
This guy, Gerald Hart, we touched on him very briefly, but he was an odd character who just showed up in your life, and he seemed to get Stefan to go along with him, and they were kind of secretive. Stan, have you ever been able to track down exactly who he was?
Well, yeah. He had his own little history that we didn't know about. He was in trouble with the law quite a bit for evading taxes or not paying taxes, business taxes. He fought a lot of cases in court, because of that. So he was sort of an activist, a local activist. But he really was, I think he was harmless. I don't think that he had any malice in mind. My mother didn't like him because he was kind of crude and kind of outspoken, and she didn't really care for him. And he sort of disappeared from our lives afterwards, and we lost track of him. And I'm sure that he's passed away long since. But he offered to help Dad, and Dad sort of said, "Well, here's another person who doesn't think I'm crazy, so I'm gonna take his help." That probably wasn't the smartest thing he could have done, because of course Jerry was already known to police. He was known to the government. But he came and went. He was brief, and then he was gone. I think whether it's Jerry or not, it's important to understand that in order to hoax something like this, you need some sophistication, you need some equipment, and you need some time. And time, place, and opportunity just weren't there.
Chris, I'm surprised that you haven't been contacted by some of the American organizations, the private organizations that are now trying to acquire and test variety of samples of metamaterials, mystery metals that have been stashed away in drawers and attics and things of that sort, supposedly from crash sites. There's a lot of interest in that stuff right now.
Yeah, I'm puzzled as well. I mean, I've spoken to Robert Bigelow a number of years ago. And over the years, people have expressed some interest in the case, but not enough to really pursue it in that regard. And given the interest in artifacts from UFOs that, you say, ATIP and so forth are really pursuing, it's possible, though, that some of these materials are already in the possession of these people, because so much of it has disappeared over the years. Maybe somebody has already provided it to them, but... it is curious, but with the renewed interest, when you've got a case like this that's so well documented by the governments and military, that you'd think that there'd be more interest in that regard.
Well, maybe I can help you there. We'll see what we can do. We'll take one more call here on the wild card line in Greensboro, North Carolina. Michael. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to bring something up. A buddy of mine and I were out in the mountains just west of Asheboro a couple of days ago, and we found something similar to what he's talking about. We have these silver, they're like nuggets or similar to nuggets. They're all kind of deformed and whatnot. And we had an XRF scan done on them. They're primarily silver. They have a little bit of titanium, rhodium, and cadmium in them. And I've not put a Geiger counter up to it, but... They're definitely interesting, not like you would normally find with silver, because normally silver's with arsenic and, you know, in an ore. This is like pure silver.
So this is just sitting on top of the ground?
No, we found it about between 4 and 6 inches deep and embedded in rock. Like there's rocks, rocky outcrops.
And Chris, the samples that the Stefan found were under the ground, right?
Yeah, they were about 4 or 5 inches underneath the ground, but very, very pure silver, commercial grade silver, 97% with some impurities. Matter of fact, just over the past week, we had the sample in a scanning electron microscope and looking for some impurities. And you know, there's things like some gold and some arsenic and so forth in there, but you know, very, very pure silver.
Thanks for the call, Michael. I would think somebody would want to go back there with the more sophisticated gear and equipment and look around and see what might be there.
Absolutely. It would be very interesting.
If you had the equipment and the time and the money to do it. I want to say when they appeared, Falcon Lake, 1967, great book, well-documented. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Stan, thank you very much for sharing your family's story, and you're welcome back here anytime if there are any other developments.
Thank you,
Chris, I can't believe it. You haven't been on the program before, but I hope you'll consider when your survey gets done and you got some results, you come back and share them with us.
Absolutely, George.
All right. Thank you very much. And again, check out that book. Thanks to our callers as well. This was When They Appeared by Stan Mihalik and Chris Rutkowski. And thanks also to my earlier guest, Dr. Diana Pasulka. American Cosmic is the name of her book. And I want to say thanks, as always, to my colleagues there at Coast, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next week. Good night, everyone.